This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I think democracy is not an event, it's a process. And I think that's why I thought in 2019 it would be very sensible to put the question back to the public to say, do we want this or not? Because certainly by 2019, more people had an idea of what the reality of Brexit was going to be than had in 2016. And all of the polls were indicating the public would have said, no, stop this nonsense now.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to this edition of the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week we find out Medway's medieval manor could be flogged off, Maidstone is worried about email scammers, and why 14-hour queues at the ports might be averted. My name is Simon Finley, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
And Daniel Edson, who covers the district and borough councils.
Hello.
As well as senior news editor Nikki White, who will be looking at what's happening at Westminster.
Hello.
How are you? Right. Later on, we'll also be joined by our special guest, Anthony Hook, the Liberal Democrat group leader at Kent County Council, as we look ahead to next May's elections. First up, Robert, what's been happening down your way in Medway?
So this week, Medway Council discussed proposals to try and reduce the burden of property maintenance budgets. As we've discussed before, Medway has a lot of pressures to get its spending under control, with a £16 million overspend predicted earlier this year. And one of the ways they're planning to do this is selling off at most 30 properties.
What sort of properties are we talking about?
So there's a range. There's Temple Manor, a 13th century manor built by the Knights Templar, currently managed by English Heritage. There's also Raynham Shopping Centre, Gillingham Golf Club, as well as a number of units on industrial estates as far away as West Yorkshire, Wales and Scotland.
That's quite a smorgasbord of property ownership, isn't it? But how much are they looking forward to raise from this, and isn't selling off the family silver a short-term fix?
So the council wants to raise £20 million from the sales within the next 5 years. But the total estimated value of all 30 properties on the list is about £35 million, so not everything would need to be sold. Council leader Vince Maple says the previous Tory administration had set targets for properties to be sold for several years and never actually met them. So this is just a case of catching up to where they ought to be. He and officers also said that these properties were on the list because they cost more to the council than they actually raise in revenue. Mm. So if that changed, they'd be taken off the list.
What have you been looking at then, Dan?
So a couple of bigwigs for Kent politics have been up in the House of Lords this week, but bad luck for them, no titles being bestowed. It was about the entry-exit system into Europe from Britain, which is obviously going to have quite a large effect on Dover. So leader of Dover District Council, Kevin Mills, was up at the Lords, and so was Roger Gough at a committee to talk about yet another delay.
This delay sort of went pretty much under the radar. I mean, you know, can you just explain what this border system will look like and why this is taking forever to bring in?
So basically, it's a new set of border checks for Britons and other non-EU citizens entering the Schengen, which is the free travel area across the continent. It requires biometric data like fingerprints and facial scans and that sort of thing. This has been in the works for ages. It was meant to come into force back in 2022, but it's been delayed by months and months, several times over. I think it's at least three or four times. It was meant to finally start in November this year, on November 10th, but then just a couple of weeks ago, the EU Commission said they're not ready on their side and it's been postponed, but this time indefinitely.
Mm. What are the politicians saying about it then?
So Councillor Mills told the House of Lords Home Affairs Committee basically that he's pretty pleased it's been delayed. He said that it'd bring gridlock on steroids to Dover, and basically he doesn't think the government are helping local authorities prepare properly for the traffic which is going to be caused by the delays in the new checks. Basically, the new security checks are expected to take way, way longer than it currently takes to cross the border from, say, the port of Dover over to Calais, so it's expected to cause ridiculous traffic which will start in Dover and then back up all the way through Kent. And Roger Gough, leader of the county council, said basically the same thing.
Obviously, all of this involves companies which get people across the channel. Have they had anything to say about it?
Yeah, actually, the companies involved in the sort of transport industry around it have said quite the opposite. GetLink Group, which owns the Channel Tunnel, sent down a representative called John Keefe, he said, you know, that they were more or less ready to start from November 10th, and that preparations for the new system over the whole course of this saga has cost Getlink Group, who own the tunnel, 67 million quid, and that they'll have no choice but to pass that on to the consumer, though that is pretty clearly a choice, because in July they posted a tidy profit of 173 million for the first quarter of this year. That's 173 million euros. Basically, the concern is that prices for getting onto the Channel Tunnel in your car or your coach or your whatever, might increase in the coming sort of year or so. But Getlink tell me that the delay is all the EU's fault, so they're going to try and pressurise the EU to compensate them in some way. But I wouldn't be particularly hopeful that the Commission will cough up on that account.
So what's happening down your way, Simon?
Well, as journalists, you'll know, Robert, we get bombarded by press releases and surveys and statistics that are of absolutely no interest to us, and probably not our readers either. And just for example, you know, I've got this one in this week. It dumped into the spam folder. It says, don't select lotto numbers based on birthdays. Study shows the luckiest and unluckiest numbers. Not that anybody in Kent is remotely interested in that, but once in a while, something does actually catch your eye that pops into your inbox. And according to the good people at a thing called QR Code Generator, a Kent town is one of the most worried about in the country about being ripped off by email scammers. Maidstone residents, I'm one of them, rank joint seventh with Gloucester over fears they are targeted by fraudsters online. And this survey is based on reputable data, I checked it, provided by the National Trading Standards.
And so how widespread is this problem?
Well, if I told you that 61 in 100,000 Google searches is what this is based on, sounds like a very small number, but apparently that is quite alarming, actually. And the most popular scam-related phrase is when residents type in reporting a scam email, and Kent County Council shares this worry, and it has its own trading standards teams dedicated to trying to contain this problem. And there's also some concern to the Police and Crime Commissioner, Matthew Scott, who described the crime as heinous.
So what has Matthew Scott said about it?
Well, Matthew has said that scammers commit heinous crimes against their victims and cause millions of pounds worth of losses to them every single year. What he did say was that if anyone is a victim of a scam of some kind, or they're worried about being a victim of a scam, they can report it to report at phishing, that's phishing.gov.uk, or sign up to his My Community Voice, which can alert police to this type of thing and get the ball moving in terms of dealing with it. KCC, on the other hand, says that if anyone is suspicious of an email, they're advised not to click on any links, do not reply to it or contact any of the senders or supply any information to external links or open attachments therein. Right. So, Nikki, what's caught your eye in the national political scene this week?
So eyes are beginning to turn to the budget, which will be announced on October the 30th and will be the Chancellor's first. Now, you'll know that we've repeatedly heard Rachel Reeves refer to this £22 billion black hole that the government has now inherited from the Tories. But a political cabinet meeting on Tuesday, she's told ministers that filling that hole alone would only be enough to keep public services standing still. Sources say Miss Reeves is drawing up plans to actually find £40 billion to avoid real-term cuts to departments, and that's inevitably going to involve tax rising and spending cuts. Ever since Labour came to power, there's been warnings of some tough decisions ahead, and you can expect that messaging will be ramped up in the coming days. Already Kent Labour MPs are stepping up their social media posts, reminding us all of some of the positive moves that have been announced so far. So this week we've seen messages come out from people such as Ashford MP Sojan Joseph, who's been reminding us that the government is backing drivers and working to cut the cost of living by tackling the high cost of car insurance. And then we've got sitting born in Sheppey MP Kevin McKenna. He's been reminding us of the announcement of £63 billion of investment to provide almost 38,000 jobs quickly, followed by another announcement of an extra £500 million for housing.
So what else has been happening?
So also this week, we've had voting start on whether or not to end hereditary peers in the House of Lords. And while many Labour MPs have been proudly declaring they voted to end it, Tory MP Roger Gale, who's the representative for Herne Bay and Sandwich, he has been tweeting about welcoming Baroness Lang of Elderslie to her seat, albeit one that she was appointed to. And he has warned people to watch the ermine fly once she gets used to the upper house.
Any of our other distinguished Kent MPs caught your eye this week?
Yeah, on a very different note, we've seen Dartford MP Jim Dixon, who was here a few weeks ago on the Politics podcast. He's been raising awareness about sepsis. He spoke in the House of Commons about John Snow, who's a father of three, and it's a story that we've previously reported on Kent Online. John had to have his arms and legs amputated, and also part of his nose was eaten away after he developed that. It's a deadly condition. So he's now in a rehabilitation centre, but he's discovered that accessing good quality prosthetics is proving a bit of a challenge. And it's a time in your life when he really needs to be concentrating purely on his recovery and not having to worry about all the things that the NHS can and cannot provide him. So Mr. Dixon has praised the people of Dartford for rallying around Mr. Snow in his time of need. There's actually a fundraiser that's been set up. And Health Minister Andrew Gwynn acknowledged... He acknowledged it highlighted the need to have better joined up care, just to ensure that people who have sepsis receive the best support possible, and that those who lose limbs, like Mr. Snow, as a consequence of sepsis, are able to get good quality aftercare, and that we just continue to raise awareness of sepsis and the risks it poses.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
At the 2001 general election, a young man barely 21 years of age stood for the Liberal Democrats in his home constituency of Dover and Deal. Anthony Hook didn't win, but it started a journey in politics that led to a seat in the European Parliament. Anthony joins us today. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, Simon. Hi, Dan.
Right. Listen, you developed an interest in politics at a quite early stage in life. What do you think sparked your interest in politics?
I think I was one of those teenagers who would watch the news, read the newspaper, and would feel quite strongly about things that I saw going on, both internationally, but also around me too. I mean, schools in the 90s, when I was a teenager, were not in a good state. When I was at school, the ceiling falling on your head was a thing that could actually happen. I mean, my school in Dover, I remember we used to go months at a time without a gym, because it was falling down and so on. And I remember feeling really angry about that, that we were being let down and not getting the education we deserved. And also internationally at that time, I remember being very moved by the Bosnian Civil War, by the genocide that we saw being committed in the former Yugoslavia. And as a teenager, feeling very strongly that shouldn't be happening. And so that led me to get more interested on Bosnia. Of course, Paddy Ashton, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, was strident and really the leading figure in saying the international community shouldn't tolerate that. And at the same time, I enjoyed all subjects at school, but including those I enjoyed were the humanities, like history. So I liked to take a long view of things, and actually religious studies, which the way it was taught at my school was very much more around ethics and arguing about morality in different situations. Mm-hmm. And a number of brilliant teachers. One of them was a chap called Richard Sewell, who'd be very well known to any of your listeners in the Deal area, who was my religious studies teacher. I think he had become an atheist himself at that point, but his lessons were all about arguing about ethical and moral issues. And I found that fascinating. And I think politics directly connects to that, because it's about putting principles into the action in the real world, where principles meet reality, and we say, what are the problems in the world and how can we try and fix them?
You were born, I believe, in Bristol, I think, wasn't it?
I was born in Bristol, and some people say I have a bit of a West Country burr.
You do. You still have a little bit of a burr, because you moved up here so when you were 7 or 8, and then you lived in Deal, and then you went to the Dover Grammar School.
That's right.
Yeah. Were your parents sort of political animals? Were they interested in politics?
No, neither of them were members of a political party, but we would sometimes talk about what was in the news, what was going on. I mean, they later got involved through me, obviously, to support me in my campaigns. And my dad stood unsuccessfully for the council and Deal after he retired. But I didn't inherit my politics from them particularly. No.
Okay. But so just in a nutshell, sort of your journey into politics, you obviously started in 2001 in terms of actually fighting an election. This was a general election. You were just about 21 years old. Up against the incumbent Labour guy, Gwyn Prosser, who had a pretty healthy majority at that time. And that's something I seem to remember was you set yourself a goal of increasing the vote share, and something you achieved at that election, then you achieved it again in 2005. It's a usual practice to sort of, pick a battle, set a goal, and try to achieve it. Is that your MO?
Yes, I think so. I mean, obviously, I would have liked to have won, but I knew in reality it was very unlikely. Very few candidates win from third place. And so the next best thing was to try and increase the vote share, but also just to make a stand and talk about some issues and offer people an alternative. Yeah.
You know, you didn't win, but you increased the share. But what happened to you after that? I think you went to university at some point as well, didn't you?
I did. So then I started my career in law when I was 23. And I trained up at the chambers in London. And in a lot of my 20s, actually, I was going all over the place. I did both civil and crime. But then for most of my 20s, specialised in crime. And there was certainly a period in my mid-20s where my life consisted of get up very early in the morning, get to a train station, go somewhere far away, like Leeds or the Isle of Wight, for the day, and come back, get back late, repeat, do the same. And it was exhausting, but exhilarating and fascinating, and I learned a lot. Actually, I mean, being a lawyer, mainly doing legal aid work as I was at that time, opened my eyes and educated me a lot. I met every kind of person you could think of, lots of people with lots of problems, saw lots of instances of people doing frankly horrible things to other human beings and the devastating consequences it had for those people. So my 20s were an amazing education, actually, an education at the expense of other people suffering, but it got me to learn about the lives of many, many people.
You worked for the Crown Prosecution Service for a while, and the guy who was the Director of Public Prosecutions at the time was a chap called Keir Starmer. You did run across him from time to time. What did you make of him?
I liked him. I only met him a few times, and not just in passing. There were a couple of instances where I had proper meetings with him, and we had to talk about cases. There was a case I did, a big cash for crash, which is a kind of insurance scam where you get someone to deliberately cause a crash to then make an insurance claim. And there have been big organized gangs doing that on an industrial level. And I was prosecuting a gang in Cambridgeshire who were doing that. And when you get very big cases like that, because of the resources that need to be thrown at the case, you get a bit of high-level supervision to make sure that case is being done well. And in my case, that was the DPP directly. I thought he was very professional. I thought he was very straight, very serious, and I liked him. I'm very surprised by the scandal over acceptance of gifts. And I think that is an error of judgment that I think is quite at odds with his history, which is a history generally of having quite sound judgment.
Yeah.
And certainly in the CPS and across the civil service, there were then, and I believe still are now, very strong prohibitions against receiving gifts for the obvious reason that as soon as you accept a gift from someone, I mean, your family and someone giving you a birthday present is one thing, but we're talking about gifts coming to you from people who are otherwise not connected to you. As soon as you accept a gift from someone, you expose yourself to the risk that if you make a decision vaguely connected to their interests, people will be concerned that the decision is influenced by the gift.
You're currently leader of the Liberal Democrat group in Kent County Council, and you've also served on other local councils. But, you know, maybe people don't remember the fact that you were actually a member of the European Parliament for a few short months at a time when you'd first become a,
a father. You were running between your constituency in Brussels and Strasbourg, wherever. What was that like? That must have been a real baptism of fire.
It was a very intense period. And I had tried very seriously to be elected to the European Parliament in 2014 and won a very competitive race to win the nomination for a seat we held where an MEP called Sharon Bowles was retiring. And in any other year, I would have been elected. But of course, that was towards the end of the Lib Dem Conservative coalition. The Lib Dems were very unpopular with some of the people who'd voted for us before. And the electorate wanted to punish the party. And I was one of the casualties of that. But then and after the results of the referendum, you know, I thought it was unlikely that I ever would be an MEP. But then we know how things worked out. And there was a European election in 2019. The party nominated me again, and I was delighted to be elected. It was an intense period because we were completely focused on trying to use that opportunity to stop Brexit, mm-hmm. which we saw and continue to see as a terrible mistake that's doing harm to our country and making life in this country worse than it would have been without Brexit. And so all the time I was working hard to do a number of things. First of all, in Brussels, to convey to people there, look, a lot of people in Britain, in fact, the majority of people in Britain, the polls indicated by that time, want to stop Brexit. Don't give up on us. But also to communicate back home to people what the benefits are, the issues I was getting stuck in with, because I took a very active part. I was on the Home Affairs Committee and the Justice Committee. I commissioned the first European Parliament report on what we could do about knife crime. I was on the committee that dealt with relations with Belarus, and I led the creation of certainly cooperation between civic society, which was with a view to in the long term making Belarus more aware of life in Europe and hopefully improving human rights in that country. I was involved in a lot of debates on Hong Kong and the suppression of human rights in Hong Kong. And it was, so it was an intense period. Now, what I was hoping to do by doing all that work was to, that would help provide evidence for people back home that, look, Europe is really important, and it's really important that we're there. And I think we came agonizingly close to stopping Brexit, but just not quite close enough.
Anthony, do you still think we should rejoin the EU?
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. I mean, do you, it would be a long, long process. Yeah, sorry.
Think that would, no, it's all right. Do you not think that would, you know, is the arguably the most important vote in British history, definitely the most important referendum in British history, because we haven't had many. Do you not think that would bear the risk of basically poisoning the well with British democracy for a generation, overturning such a major vote, which we've only just gotten past? And you know, you say you try to sort of, you think that the case needs to be made in Britain for the EU, but do you not think, you know, the state of, yeah, frankly, the state of human rights in Belarus is not why people voted for or against Brexit. They voted because of, you know, many, many other problems, not least for immigration.
You know, I think democracy is not an event, it's a process. And I think that's why I thought in 2019 it would be very sensible to put the question back to the public to say, do we want this or not? Because certainly by 2019, more people had an idea of what the reality of Brexit was going to be than had in 2016. And all of the polls were indicating the public would have said, no, stop this nonsense now. And I also think at some point in the future, I mean, don't get me wrong, Dan, we will not rejoin this year, next year, anytime soon. It will be at least another 10 years from now, I think. And we would have to persuade the 27 that it's in their interest to have Britain back in, which would be a big challenge. So I think it will be at least another 10 years from now by the time we do rejoin, but we've got to start having the conversation. And I think by the time we get to, say, the mid-2030s, the British public that exists today should be entitled to make a choice. And it would ring pretty hollow to say to 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds in 2030, you can't have a decision on this because your parents' generation in 2016 made a decision by a very narrow margin. And you're absolutely right. I mean, no one down the dock and darkest about human rights in Belarus, but that is just one small example of the importance of Europe working together. Ukraine is a much bigger and more obvious example. And if we're going to stop Putin from getting his tentacles into life all over Europe, including our country, Bear in mind, he's already had the gall to send agents to this country to drop poison in Salisbury. If we're going to push Putin back, we really need to be united about it.
Okay. After the 2010 coalition and the dropping of the policy on tuition fees, the Liberal Democrats were in a bit of a trough, to say the least. Yet neither party posts 72 MPs, I think that's correct. Given the state of the Tories, can you seriously become the official opposition of Her Majesty's government?
I think so. And that said, Davies stated aim for the next election is that we replace the Conservatives, and they're not that much bigger than us now in terms of MPs. And I think something that's very clear is that we occupy the centre ground and they're drifting off further and further to the hard right. And with a party that is pro the environment and also pro business, being pro business is the centre ground position. Extreme left and extreme right is very bad for business and therefore bad for people's standard of living and wages. And I think that people will see we're a party that they can trust and are in touch with the issues that they care about. Yeah. I think we can go up and up.
The Lib Dems have long supported proportional representation, like a lot of other small parties in the UK. It's sort of their flagstone issue. I'm guessing you still back that, but do you not recognise maybe that might make things quite interesting for the Lib Dems? Because on raw popular vote share, your party's less popular than the Reform Party, and Reform only has, what, 4 or 5 MPs on basically the same vote share as the Lib Dems, who have, what, something like 60 or 70. Surely that is quite unfair.
Oh, it is unfair. Yeah, every vote should count, and every vote should count equally. And the first-past-the-post system is an absolute disgrace, and it should be replaced by proportional representation as soon as possible, definitely.
Yeah. Well, how much of a threat do you see coming from Reform UK in the next 5 years?
I think there's a ceiling on their support, that kind of hard right position where they think the root of all problems is foreigners. That's if we just get rid of foreigners, everything will be better. I think it's obviously nonsense. And I think most people know it to be nonsense. And we had a by-election here in Faversham in August, and they put in an energetic campaign, but we're saying crazy things. I mean, as Dan knows, we've talked about it, the Faversham Bridge here is a long-standing campaign of mine to get our swing bridge fixed. The bridge opens and then the waterway can be used. And Reform put out a video saying that the old bridge, the one that was broken, had been given to Germany. I mean, it's just complete fantasy. They strike me as people who have a lot of conspiracy theories. And I think, therefore, there's a limit to how much of the population will support them. In the days of UKIP, there was a statistic, there was about 20% of the country would consider supporting UKIP. And that's not a big enough market to make a serious breakthrough.
So obviously it's only a few months now until the KCC election next year. What do you rate your chances being? There's a lot of people saying that, you know, the Tories might take a battering and a rainbow coalition of everyone but the Tories and maybe everyone except Reform could seize KCC next year. What do you rate your chances of maybe being KCC leader of a very broad coalition?
I'm really excited about next year's KCC elections. I think there is a first chance in 30 years to take the Conservatives out of political control in Kent, where I think they've been quite complacent. They take Kent for granted. They think they'll always run Kent, and it's time for a change. There's lots of things in elections you can't control, so I'll be concentrating on things I can, which is supporting Lib Dem candidates. And our group is currently 6, one behind Labour, and I'm hoping to at least double that number and get it into a significant two-digit number. And just last week I had a meeting with some candidates from Canterbury, Seven Oaks, Maidstone, who are interested in standing, and this Saturday I'm popping down to Tunbridge Wells to sit down and have a talk with some people there who are interested in standing and interested in being county councillors.
I spoke to Stuart Jeffrey back in the last week. He's the leader of Maidstone Borough Council of the Green Party. He'll be standing in Maidstone Central, and he will be one of your biggest rivals in terms of the kind of target seats that they'll be going for. And he sort of seemed to think, well, he couldn't call it really about how each of the opposition parties might do. The known unknown, obviously, is Reform. But he reckoned that, you know, each of those parties, Liberal Democrats, Labour and the Green Party, could all take about 15 each.
I'd be surprised if the Greens do as well as that, to be honest, if you look across Kent. But I mean, obviously, I'll be focused on the Lib Dems doing well. We've got a brilliant MP in Tunbridge Wells, Mike Martin, and we'll therefore be hoping to win all of the seats in Tunbridge Wells. And we've also got a huge track record in Maidstone. We've got two county councillors there already, and the Greens have none. And we'll be looking to regain Maidstone South, which was Lib Dem held until a few elections ago. And in Maidstone Central, brilliant county councillor Chris Passmore, and we'll be really looking to gain the second seat back from the Conservatives. And Maidstone Central has been Lib Dem held for decades, so I think Maidstone is somewhere where we'll do well, and we might end up as the largest of the non-Conservative parties. That's very possible.
Well, no one seems to think that the Conservatives won't be the biggest party. Whether they'll get the 41 or 42 they'll need to actually take control is a moot point. And very few of the backbenchers that I speak to really have a great deal of confidence. It's only blind optimism that's keeping them going in some cases. And a lot of them are standing down. I mean, I think the last count's 27. That may change upwards or downwards, who knows. But yeah, right about 27 of the current 59 are going to stand down. So there's only 32 incumbents potentially, and that's a problem because incumbency does give you some advantage, particularly if you've been kicking around the place for quite a long time.
It does. Incumbency is a proven electoral fact that, generally speaking, incumbency gives you an advantage over a new candidate who isn't known. And the fact that that Kent Online has revealed that so many Conservatives are walking away at the next election just goes to show that their confidence, their morale, as you say, Simon, is really quite low. But life goes on, and what concerns me is the problems that people and families in Kent are facing go on, and they need good councillors to represent them effectively. So that's why we'll be putting up a full slate of candidates, a candidate in every seat, and I'll be looking to get a lot of those people elected.
Yeah. Very quickly, and just before we wrap up, I mean, should the Conservatives lose power and the Lib Dems are part of a controlling administration, I mean, the council faces some pretty dire years ahead. The funding settlements aren't getting any better from central government, and the cost of providing the statutory services continues just to rise. I mean, how are the Lib Dems and the Labour Party and the Green Party going to do that in coalition any better than the Conservatives are doing it at the minute?
It's going to be very challenging, and I don't think we'll fully know the picture yet, because we've got to see what comes out in the Chancellor's budget later this month. Is she going to give local government fairer funding? And will she give an indication what that funding will be over several years, not just one year at a time? Would be a great help. And one problem with being in opposition, as I am now, is you don't get to see as much information as you do when you're in administration. So if there's a change of control, we need to get in, particularly in the finance directorate, to sit down and get a very clear picture of what the situation is. But I think what people can bear in mind, though, is that whoever's in charge of the financial position will not be easy. But I think the Conservative group has people among them who are less supportive of public services than people in, certainly in the Liberal Democrats group are. I mean, I've been to meetings of the scrutiny committee where members of the Conservative group seem to object to disabled children receiving support as if that's a bad thing in principle, and who Conservatives who just want a smaller say and want smaller services and think the council should do less and people should just get on with it. Well, that's not our view. We understand that people really need help, and the strongest in society want the weakest to receive help with their lives. So we'll be coming at it from, I hope, a caring and understanding viewpoint.
Yeah, okay. Okay, do you have any aspirations to become an MP in the future?
No, not at the moment. I mean, tremendous respect for people who do, and I've got friends who were elected in the last election, but I consider myself very lucky. I've got two children, and I love being at home for them almost every day, and I have a day job as a lawyer that I enjoy, and I really enjoy my work as a member of Kent County Council, so I feel quite blessed, and I feel I make a difference in all three of those roles, and so I'm very happy as I am for now.
Yeah. Councillor Anthony Hook, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure to speak to you as always, and hope to speak to you soon.
Thank you both very much.
Okay. Transport Secretary Louise Haig found herself in choppy waters when she described P&O Ferries as a rogue operator for firing 800 crew and replacing them with cheaper foreign agency staff. This on the eve of an important summit where P&O's owner, DP World, was about to invest £1 billion in the United Kingdom. Louise Haig's call for a boycott of P&O was dismissed by Sir Keir Starmer as not the view of the government. Dan, what do you make of all this?
So, I mean, for starters, I think it's interesting that the government got so angry about her personally using these phrases when a press release from the Department of Transport itself only a week or so ago used the words rogue operators, said it will bring in new legislation to protect seafarers from rogue operators, didn't directly call P&O a rogue operator, but discussed
who it was,
discussed in detail the scandalous sacking of 800 people to hire them with cheap, you know, to replace them with cheaper agency workers a few years ago. So, and not to mention Keir Starmer, when he was leader of the Labour Party when all of those seafarers got sacked, and he was pretty open that he said it made his blood boil, that it was disgusting, all this kind of thing. And on the one hand, obviously, you know, you don't want to have your ministers causing potential problems, which might, I guess, disrupt investment from companies. But on the other hand, surely ministers of the government can be trusted to basically slag off openly dodgy employers who've obviously, you know, they've done something which generated mass public outrage, and that every single member of the Labour Party, for certain, and probably the vast majority of people in the country, found to be completely ridiculous.
Well, I mean, let's face it, everybody in Kent probably knows someone who has worked for P&O in the past. It's been a big local employer. I remember doing a story many years back when they were going to lay off a few hundred people, which was a big deal at the time, but it was not a massive proportion of the overall staff. And the company said that I think it was 80% of its workforce came from the CT, ME and TM postcodes. So it was quite a big deal for a lot of families in Kent who were affected by that, and presumably it was the same when it happened in 2022.
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive local employer, along with many other industries that are formerly based in this country. The maritime economy increasingly hires people from abroad, often from third world and developing countries, so they can pay them, or more easily get away with paying them, international maritime standard wages, which of course are decent, but that's relative to the fact that the vast majority of the world's population live in extremely poor countries. So the defence P&O always used when they were criticised for the sacking people off to replace them with agency workers was, we pay people British minimum wage when we're in British territorial waters. When we're at sea, we pay them in line with international maritime regulations, which is, of course, perfectly legal. But international maritime minimum wage, you know, is not brilliant by any standards. So, you know, if the government really wants to make a statement and potentially patch up relations with Louise Haig, they should, you know, maybe consider lobbying for more changes to international maritime law. And further to that, there's still, as far as I know, been absolutely no punishment for the former CEO, well, I think he's still CEO, of Peter Hebblethwaite, who's definitely CEO of P&O at the time, who openly said in the parliamentary committee that they had violated the law by sacking all these people without consultation with their unions because they have collective bargaining arrangements, which means the unions need to be consulted. And he can just openly say this to Parliament and face absolutely no recourse. And a Labour government, you know, governed by ostensibly the party of the unions, I think they'd be looking at an open goal if they tried to pursue some kind of action against him.
They are trying to change the employment rules around that sort of thing. But again, just for the sake of the listeners, can you just explain roughly what they're trying to do with that?
So the government's trying to bring in new workers' rights rules, which will essentially make it harder for people to be fired at short notice from their jobs
and fire and rehire.
The substance of what that regulation will actually entail will probably take God knows how long for it to be revealed.
I think this is sort of showing another trouble which possibly the Labour Party is grappling which is the difference between being in opposition and being in government. And when you're in opposition, you can say lots of radical things and you can be quite vociferous and say, you know, P&O is a rogue operator and this sort of thing. But when you're in government, now all of a sudden you need P&O to invest and all these sort of things, and you're trying to balance, you know, doing what you were elected on and representing, as we said, workers and that sort of thing, but also not annoying businesses. And they, you know, because they pulled out £1 billion of investment and now it's been reinvested. I don't know. But it's been brought back. And I think the interesting thing as well is, I think this is a story we've seen quite a few times of the Labour Party not being very good at communicating what they're doing, because as we've just talked about, these changes which they're bringing in, one of them which I sort of really noticed was around 0-hour contracts, which basically the plan is to make, if you don't want to be on a 0-hour contract, you can't be forced into doing it. You can have like a minimum amount of hours, which you will always get, because that's what a lot of people who are on 0-hour contracts say is, you know, they need a dependable amount of hours to make a living. But that's not really being communicated by the Labour Party. Instead, we're talking about they've annoyed this P&O person and, you know, Louise Hague is getting a sort of a slap on the wrist behind closed doors. It's not really the substance, which I think the people would look favourably on these changes, the majority of people anyway, but instead we're talking about something else.
Yeah, it's a classic thing of being able to try and find a sort of a nice settled middle way. You know, back in the 80s and early 90s when, you know, we worked in the newspaper industry, I mean, they were run by the unions, and literally any small discrepancy, and they would have their members out on strike, be it the journalists or be it the printers or the compositors or whoever's. And then sort of as time went on and you know, we developed a sort of like a middle ground where, you know, the unions have influence but not power as such. We're getting to a point where we're not quite sure where the Labour Party stands on union relations, and particularly about protecting workers' rights, which do seem to have been eroded in recent years.
The Labour Party's relationship with unions, who for a long time have historically held its purse strings, is something that dogs them in government pretty much every time they've been in government. Like even recently at the Labour conference a few weeks ago, fringe events sponsored by different unions who allied themselves with different factions of the parties. I think his name's Gary Smith, the General Secretary of the GMB. Proven to be a pretty frosty friend to the new government, because he's basically says that the government's climate policies and net zero targets are completely unreachable and that they're completely unserious about industrial strategy. Sharon Graham, General Secretary of Unite, the union, which was basically, you know, Corbyn's bank, they've, you know, sort of given a bit less money to the Labour Party and have quite frosty relations with it. And it's been noticed the Labour Party, this is a trend that's existed for many decades, but it's particularly heightened at the moment. The Labour Party is depending less on trade unions and more on the donations of basically extraordinarily wealthy individuals. And that's a trajectory which is shared among many supposedly workers' parties in Western Europe. But whether that expresses itself in their policy decisions on stuff like workers' rights will be interesting to watch.
But it's not a bad thing for the unions to have a slightly fractious relationship with the top table of the Labour Party, isn't it?
No, not at all. If the interests of workers aren't aligned with what the Labour government and the Labour Party is arguing for, they should express their independence in that way. And maybe that'll be progress in some way, shape or form. But for a lot of them, even if they're critical of the Labour Party, it's still in the form of an intervention into Labour politics rather than separating themselves from it. I think the only major union which isn't directly related to the Labour Party is the RMT, and that's for long-standing historical reasons.
I'm sure the P&O story will run and run and run. Okay, folks, that's your lot this week. Thanks to Nikki, Rob and Dan, and to our special guest, Anthony Hook. Don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. And you can also sign up to our newly launched politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters/. And finally, don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5:00. All the best now.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.